Chapter 3, Hormones and Bones. Case number 1, Josh. Josh is a 26-year-old cisgender Caucasian male graduate student. He developed anorexia nervosa at age 17. After one residential treatment episode a year ago, he's been maintaining a low but improved body weight. An avid cyclist, he continues to ride with a cycling group 5 days a week. He lifts weights 1 day a week and hikes or plays frisbee with his friends the other day. Josh's left shin has begun to hurt after he cycles, and massages aren't helpful. 4 weeks later, an MRI confirms a tibial stress fracture. Faced with the prospect of backing off on his normal exercise routines, Josh finds himself thinking more and more about restriction. As he teeters on the brink of acting on disordered behaviors, he decides to set up his visits with an outpatient therapist and dietitian to twice a week. Josh's intensive work reminds him that he does not want to relapse and go back to treatment, missing out on school and the social connections he's come to value so much. He realizes that the focus on leanness and healthy eating in his cycling group are contributing to his unwillingness to finish restoring weight. Josh sees a sports medicine doctor who advises him to see a specialist in eating disorders. He has never had a bone density scan, so the sports medicine doctor orders one. Josh notes that his sex drive disappeared during the most intense years of his anorexia nervosa and hasn't fully recovered. He wakes with spontaneous erections less often than when he was a teenager and had been ascribing this to getting older. His bone scan shows Z-scores of negative 2.6 in the spine, negative 2.2 at the femoral neck, and negative 2.0 at the total hip. Normal greater than negative 1.0. His morning total testosterone level on two occasions prior to his specialist visit was found to be 225 and 229 ng per dl respectively. The normal is 280 to 1100. Case number 2, Ania. Ania is a 30-year-old cisgender Middle Eastern American female who works in finance. Ania's anorexia nervosa started and menstrual periods stopped when she was 18, and she received long-term outpatient treatment at that time. She felt she had achieved a good recovery by age 27. However, despite now being at the same weight as when she was 18, her periods have never restarted. She exercises moderately and mindfully, mostly doing yoga or going on walks with friends. Her gynecologist has offered to put her on the pill to jumpstart her period. A bone density scan 5 years ago was read as normal. Ania sees an eating disorder physician for a thorough evaluation. Her estradiol levels come back at 15 ng per ml. Normal levels vary day by day of the menstrual cycle, but are usually greater than 30 ng per ml. A repeated bone density scan shows negative 1.8 in the spine, negative 1.6 at the femoral neck, and negative 1.5 at the total hip. The official read says, within the expected range for age. A pelvic ultrasound reveals that her uterus and ovaries are small, with sizes more commonly seen in a 12-year-old. Case 3, Aiden. Aiden is a 17-year-old cisgender Caucasian male who developed anorexia nervosa, restricting subtype, when he was 12. He's been in and out of treatment programs where he consistently feels isolated as one of the two or three male patients in a sea of females. He doesn't get out much of sitting in a body group and hearing his peers talk about their periods. In fact, he feels like he somehow has to apologize when girls talk about male-inflicted traumas they've experienced. Aiden feels further isolated from his peers since he has absolutely no interest in dating and no sex drive whatsoever. The idea of relationships or intimacy is overwhelming and unimaginable to him. Although Aiden's father is 6 foot and his mother is 5 foot 7, Aiden is 5 foot 2 and has restored weight fully twice, briefly, only to relapse again after residential treatment. He has not grown much since his eating disorder started and has delayed puberty. His family wonders if he should be started on growth hormone or testosterone now that he's finishing residential treatment again and is nearing his target body weight. One day, Aiden trips over a curb and falls. After a week of intense foot pain, he learns his foot is broken in 2 places. Concerned, the urgent care doctor asks about his bone density. No one has ever checked it. Background. Hormones and bones are topics that bring a lot of patients with eating disorders into my clinic. For some patients, going through puberty is the initial trigger for disordered eating. As puberty launches, girls who fear change and feel highly perfectionistic to see their bodies start to transform in a way that feels alien. They begin to become feminized in a world where being female can come with a lot of expectations and burdens. Rightly enough, they might learn in science class that one must have a certain amount of body fat in order to start to begin menstruating. In some cases, this scientific truth leads preteens to think that the arrival of their period means that they're fat. In fact, it is normal for girls to gain 30 or more pounds during adolescence. That can happen gradually or rapidly, depending on growth patterns. Possibly no one tells these girls how wonderfully normal and healthy this is. In our thin, focused society, where models can be shaped like tall, lanky 11-year-olds with breasts, parents and kids can overreact to absolutely appropriate body changes, including typical growth and concomitant weight changes. Adolescent weight gain may start with kids looking generally heavier or thicker around the middle, which is normal. Children don't typically spring fully formed into their adult proportions. Given the sensitivity of adolescents generally, wayward comments from family members like, "Whoa, I think you've had enough mashed potatoes," or "Maybe you need to get out and run a little more," can have a painful impact. Families want what's best for their kids, and their comments about eating and activity may intend to foster health. But families too need to educate themselves about necessary weight gain and body changes. Teenagers, barraged by commercial and social messages about their inadequacies and faults, deserve to feel safe and accepted in their bodies at home. It may be the only safe space in which they can do so. Normally, girls acquire up to 90% of peak bone mass by age 18, and boys acquire the same percentage by age 20. By one's early 20s, the window shuts for further significant deposition of bone density. This is the skeleton that the person will have for the rest of their life. Bone then continually remodels itself throughout our lives, as small amounts are constantly being formed and resorbed. In general, this balance remains neutral, and our bone density remains normal until later in life. However, bone density loss can occur early and rapidly with malnutrition, even while the body weight is still normal. Of all the medical complications of malnutrition, bone density loss is the only one that is not fully reversible. The signs of bone density loss and hypothalamic hypogonadism. During starvation, our clever cave person brain surveys the situation and understands that now is not a safe time for making babies. Sex drive, pursuing a partner, losing menstrual blood monthly, and carrying a pregnancy would take up too many calories and body resources. So, the cave person brain begins an intricate hormonal alteration to protect our body during this low-resource time. It shuts down the part of the brain responsible for initiating sex hormone production, the hypothalamus. The term for this process is hypothalamic hypogonadism. During starvation, the hypothalamus resets its hormonal production to pre-adolescent levels. By altering how gonadotropin-releasing hormones, or GnRH, are released. Abnormal GnRH pulses cause low levels of luteinizing hormone, or LH, and follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH, to be released from the anterior pituitary. Low LH and FSH lead to low estrogen and testosterone synthesis in the ovaries and testicles, respectively. In addition, the cave person brain induces growth hormone resistance and decreases insulin-like growth factor 1 or IGF-1 concentrations. Our stress hormone, the natural steroid cortisol, rises to help us manage the physiological stress of malnutrition and underweight. All of these changes and more occur relatively rapidly during starvation. In response, bone density begins to fall. The bone microarchitecture becomes impaired, bone strength decreases, and fracture risk increases. Both cortical-rich or long bone and trabecular-rich or spinal bone sites are affected. However, trabecular-rich spinal bone is particularly influenced because it is more metabolically active and has a higher turnover rate. Bone density is often discussed as it pertains to women following menopause, but there are key differences between bone density loss in postmenopausal women and in malnourished people. After menopause, women's estrogen levels fall, which means that more bone is resorbed than previously in their lives. However, if she is otherwise healthy, she will continue to make new bone. Bone density declines rapidly right after menopause and then slowly declines thereafter, as a little more bone is resorbed than newly made. In some ways, similarly, in starvation, estrogen levels are also low and thus bone is resorbed. However, due to all of the other hormonal changes, from growth hormone resistance to low IGF-1 levels to high cortisol levels, the starving person reduces new bone production. As a result, bone density loss can be remarkably rapid. Indeed, the bone density loss from anorexia nervosa looks physiologically and biochemically similar to bone density loss in individuals who have to take high doses of steroids for inflammatory conditions. Presumably, our own high levels of cortisol, our stress steroid, causes similar changes to patients on chronic pharmaceutical steroids. An important study found that girls and young women with anorexia nervosa have a 60% fracture increase when compared with age-matched controls, even before bone scans showed reduced bone mineral density. The higher risk for fracture was observed as early as 1 year into the diagnosis of patients' anorexia nervosa, and the results were independent of the amount of exercise being done. Fracture is the biggest concern in bone density loss, and notably, patients with any history of anorexia nervosa have a 200 to 300% increase in fracture risk. Some of my patients might think, "What's the big deal? Fine, I won't trip over the cat and break something." First, as in Josh's case, stress fractures can sideline athletes for weeks or months. The consequence of stress fracture can range from pain and disability to frustration at not being able to participate in one's sport, to threatened loss of scholarship funding for elite college athletes. Second, one can develop permanent kyphosis, a permanently hunched upper back. Our spine is made up of vertical bodies like building blocks, one on top of the other. When the vertebral bodies become too fragile, they can start to lose height and crunch down on themselves, like a sponge cake that flattens. These are called compression fractures. Furthermore, because of our body's mechanics, so that a person's upper spine is permanently curved forward. No amount of posture work or yoga can fully fix this curvature once the bone is altered. I have seen patients even in their 20s and 30s with kyphosis. Third, patients can end up with chronic bony pain from compression fractures. It's a sad and powerful sight to witness a young person relegated permanently to a walker on strong pain medications that cause dependency, constipation, and heightened pain sensitivity. Diagnosis of bone density loss. Bone density loss is typically diagnosed with a dual energy X-ray absorptiometry, DEXA or DXA scan. In adults, images are taken of the lumbar spine, femoral neck, total hip, and sometimes the forearm. Results are then reported as either a T score for postmenopausal women and men 50 or older, or a Z score for children, premenopausal women, and men under 50. While some controversy exists about how exactly to evaluate children's and adolescents' bone density results, consensus exists that only spinal measurements should be measured, with the results reported out as a Z score. The International Society for Clinical Densitometry, ISCD, has established how to interpret DXA scores. These vary by age groups and are important for patients and families to know about. This is because we must always view the standard results through the lens of the eating disorder physiology. A bone density result shows that clinically significant bone density loss in someone with anorexia nervosa may be interpreted by the radiologist as normal by ISCD standards. Below, I explain the ISCD's methodology for interpreting DXA findings. This can be seen in Table 3.1. The lowest score determines the overall diagnosis. It is not medically sound to say, I have osteoporosis in my spine, but osteopenia in my hips. If there is osteoporosis anywhere, the diagnosis is osteoporosis. Individual patients' information about clinical presence of fracture or secondary cause of bone density loss is not included on a DXA scan report. Many of the patients have been told their DXA is normal when in fact they actually meet full criteria for osteoporosis once all of the information is taken into account. Additionally, we have to pay attention not just to the official read on the radiology report, but to what results are expected. Athletes, for instance, should have a 5 to 15% higher bone density than non-athletes because they expose their bodies to bone-loading exercise on a regular basis. Such exercise gives an electrical signal to the bones to thicken and become stronger. For instance, the bones in a pitcher's throwing arm are stronger than his non-throwing arm. The American College of Sports Medicine and International Olympic Committee define normal bone density in athletes participating in weight-bearing sports as negative 1 or better. However, if the DXA scan shows a Z score of anything higher than negative 2.0, the official read will say, within expected range for age, doctors must therefore appropriately interpret the results for the patient. Otherwise, we miss the opportunity to highlight pathology emerging from the eating disorder, to diagnose and treat fragile bones, and to prevent future problems and motivate recovery. When a female patient loses their period, a DXA should be performed within a year, either in the context of anorexia nervosa or athletics. For those women who don't lose their periods, the DXA should be checked within a year or so of restrictive behaviors having started. In children and adolescents with anorexia nervosa, the timing is less clear. Certainly, if they have any long bone fractures, a DXA should be checked. However, since fracture risk is already increased by 60% after 1 year of anorexia nervosa, Patients and parents should be informed of this risk and promptly pursue treatment. Males often get missed by the medical system on this issue. Within a year of anorexia nervosa diagnosis or behaviors, they too need a baseline bone density evaluation. As a physician, I want to ensure that patients and families are aware of the current state of the art diagnosis and treatment of bone density loss due to eating disorders, hoping that this empowers them to bring the evidence without delay to their practitioners. I have seen many cases of delayed diagnosis and improper treatment of patients with regard to their bones over the years. It's critical to get the message to the person who matters the most, the one whose body is being affected. I will also note that the science constantly evolves. These are the evidence-based treatments at the time of this writing. Perhaps not surprisingly, the gold standard of treatment for bone density loss due to anorexia nervosa is full weight restoration, which in females may be accompanied by the return of a regular menstrual period. Every study on the topic has shown that patients who restore their weight fully can regain some bone density. As will be discussed further below, many restart their period while still underweight. This does not mean they are done restoring weight. Unfortunately, complete normalization of bone mineral density after anorexia nervosa is rare. It is the one medical complication of anorexia nervosa that may never fully resolve. Every single day that someone is underweight from malnutrition, they lose skeletal strength. In adolescents with anorexia nervosa, every day that passes they're still underweight is another day that they are not mineralizing their bones to last the rest of their lives. Adequate calcium and vitamin D intake makes sense, but these alone do not make a difference in improving bone density. In pill form, a person can only absorb 500 milligrams of calcium at a time. The vitamin DOH level should be kept above 30 ng per UL. I always believe food sources are best for one's vitamins and minerals, but over-the-counter calcium and vitamin D tablets are fine as well. Some people find that taking calcium supplements causes constipation or nausea. Well-designed trials have now given us good data on the pharmaceutical treatment of bone density loss from malnutrition. That said, each patient is an individual, and treatment must be offered accordingly. I will discuss the oral contraceptive pill more in the menstrual function section at the end of this chapter. The key takeaway with regards to the pill is this: oral contraceptive pills do not work for bone density loss, as proven over and over again among adolescents, athletes, and adults. Despite this, oral contraceptives continue to be prescribed inappropriately because practitioners were taught that the pill protects your bones and jumpstarts your period. This is incorrect. That said, transdermal estrogen, also called the estrogen patch, is emerging a terrific treatment option for amenorrheic women with either anorexia nervosa or exercise-induced bone density loss or poor bone accrual. The low-dose estrogen patch, which is not a contraceptive, is thought to be effective because it delivers estrogen, a bone antiresorptive, to the body without having a negative first-pass effect at the liver. First-pass metabolism refers to a process by which medicines taken by mouth are processed and eliminated by the gut and the liver before ever reaching the rest of the body. Unlike the oral contraceptive pill, which does have a first-pass effect and down-regulators of IGF-1 production at the liver, transdermal estrogen does not regulate IGF-1, an important bone-building hormone. Low-dose patch estrogen has also been shown to improve bone density when used as a bridge to the gold standard of weight restoration. It may take months for someone with bone density loss and amenorrhea to restore sufficient weight and maintain it for enough time to correct the low estrogen or high stress hormone state that contributes to bone density loss. Even imagining that the weight restoration process is smooth and continuous, which is by no means the case, the individual will still be losing both bone density daily. Thus, use of a transdermal estrogen patch helps boost bone density until the person can naturally support bone health. The patch may not allow full catch-up of bone density levels, but it still helps. Studies have even shown that the estrogen patch helps with the memory and cognition in young athletes with irregular or absent periods. The dose is typically a 100 milligram or microgram, sorry, of 17 beta estradiol patch applied to the skin twice weekly. Once a month for 10 consecutive days, the woman must also take a form of progesterone so that the uterus is not exposed to unopposed estrogen. This is best taken at night when our natural progesterone peaks and causes mild sleepiness, as 10 milligrams of medroxyprogesterone or 200 milligrams of micronized progesterone. This regimen should be started as soon as low bone density is diagnosed in a woman under 50 who loses her period in the setting of inadequate calorie intake. Presently, there are a number of as evidence-based prescription treatments for anorexia-mediated bone density loss. All of them have significant drawbacks, but they are still vital tools in the toolbox. The class of medicines called the bisphosphonates are anti-resorptive medications. That is, they help keep the bone from being broken down. A randomized controlled trial in 2011 showed for the first time that bisphosphonates do improve bone density loss in young women with anorexia nervosa more than the placebo, as measured by DXA 1 year later. They are not hard to take. The dose is usually one pill once a week in the morning on an empty stomach. Sitting up for half an hour after taking this medication helps prevent heartburn. However, bisphosphonates stay in the system for a long time, well beyond the period of actively taking the medicine. They also cross the placenta, and animal studies have shown that they harm fetuses, although limited human observational studies of pregnant women taking bisphosphonates have not demonstrated harm to the baby. There is also a rare but meaningful risk of jaw osteonecrosis, meaning bone breakdown, from the bisphosphonates. The decision to use a bisphosphonate or not becomes an individualized one for females, taking into account risk of harm from bone density loss versus risk of harm from a pharmaceutical. For women of current or future childbearing age, the amenorrhea and bone density loss, I almost always start with transdermal estrogen and weight restoration. For a young woman who has fully weight restored, has her period back, and has progressive and significant osteoporosis, especially with fracture history, I will consider a bisphosphonate only if I'm convinced she has neither the interest nor the ability to get pregnant in the immediate future. This might apply to a 19-year-old college student with severe bone density loss and an intrauterine IUD in place. For recovered women who are ready to partner and have kids in the next few years, and who don't have any fractures or deformities arising from their bone density, I will hold off on bisphosphonates for the time being. In these patients, I recommend weight maintenance, mindful weight-bearing exercise, and adequate calcium and vitamin D intake. The last pharmaceutical to discuss that is currently evidence-based for patients with eating disorders is teriparatide. Teriparatide is, by contrast with bisphosphonates, an anabolic agent. That means it promotes bone formation. A well-designed study showed that it may significantly more affect than the bisphosphonates in adults with anorexia nervosa. It may significantly be more effective than bisphosphonates in adults with anorexia nervosa. However, teriparatide is harder to take. It is administered daily, subcutaneous. It is administered via a daily subcutaneous injection and must be refrigerated at all times. It is enormously expensive, and it's often a complicated dance to get insurance to cover it. There is a black box warning that comes with teriparatide about a risk of it causing bone cancer or osteosarcoma. This emerges from rat studies, wherein rats given 3 to 60 times the relative human dose of teriparatide had such bone growth stimulation that it turned cancerous. In 15 years of subsequent studies, not a single human case of attributable bone cancer has been reported. This medicine cannot be used in those who have not attained their full adult height. I reserve its use for adult patients who have severe bone density loss and/or a history of prolonged or complicated fracture healing. It is used for only 2 years because of the theoretical risk of bone cancer. After that, it may need to be followed by a bisphosphonate so that the treatment is effective and not lost. In women with appropriate estrogen levels or males with appropriate testosterone levels, after the 2-year course, a bisphosphonate may not be needed. Exercise and bone density loss. Many of my patients over the years have asked me about the role of exercise in their bone health. In some cases, their anorexia nervosa hopes for a medical reason to keep exercising excessively. A very good study out of Canada helped me to answer this question. A group of young women with anorexia nervosa and amenorrhea and a recovered group who were weight restored and had resumption of their menstrual periods tracked their exercise. Those who were still ill, who exercised even moderately, and the authors included restlessly walking around in the moderate category, developed worse bone density than ill patients who did not exercise. The good news, though, was that after recovery, even high-intensity exercise improved bone density compared with not exercising. It makes sense that when the body is nutritionally stressed and hormonally depleted, requiring it to exercise would further deplete its stores. I address my recommendations about moving or movement during recovery in the box at the end of this chapter. I specifically discuss athletes in Chapter 16. Males. When males have hypothalamic hypogonadism, they stop producing sufficient testosterone. It's very important for doctors to ask their male patients with eating disorders if they've had any sexual function. Typically, to receive the diagnosis of hypothalamic hypogonadism, a male must have 2 morning blood draws showing a total testosterone level less than 300 ng per dL and manifest at least a few symptoms of low testosterone, such as decreased sex drive, sexual dysfunction, reduced incidence of spontaneous erections, body hair loss, muscle mass loss, increase in body fat, decrease in energy, and low bone density or depression. The combination of low testosterone and the stress of malnutrition contribute to early bone density loss. In fact, males with anorexia nervosa appear to lose bone density faster at a higher relative body weight and fracture more easily than females. My clinical experience is that doctors forget to consider bone density in the male patients with eating disorders. I've had male patients who have been malnourished for years, and no one ever thought to order a DXA. If a male patient of mine has never had a DXA, even if he is near the beginning of an eating disorder, I'll check a baseline bone density level. As with females, they should be checked every 2 years thereafter until recovered. Annual follow-ups may be preferred during early diagnosis and treatment, but insurance may not pay. If my patient has both low bone density and low testosterone levels, the first line treatment is with topical testosterone. Testosterone has a similar effect as bisphosphonates and estrogen, which is to prevent bone resorption. The goal for treatment is to keep the total testosterone level within the normal range. Levels can be checked every few months. Of course, weight restoration means the overall gold standard of treatment. There are a few important considerations when it comes to prescribing testosterone. One is that the treatment with testosterone will revive sex drive and sexual function. If these themes are problematic for my patient, I recommend he and his therapist work on this before starting hormone replacement. In addition, the National College Athletic Association and World Anti-Doping Agency prohibit therapeutic testosterone use in athletes, even if medically indicated for an eating disorder. In athletes wishing to compete, nutritional management alone must be pursued. Testosterone can be stopped once the patient has achieved a healthy body weight range, as it would be expected that natural testosterone production will resume in the near future. Levels should still be checked to confirm that this has occurred. Ultimately, no one aims to create testosterone-fueled monsters, as some patients fear. The idea is to replace what currently is absent only until the body begins again to produce its own sex hormones. In adolescent males, even up through their early 20s, low bone density and low testosterone, it is vital to assess whether they have achieved their adult height before proceeding with testosterone therapy. Because starvation temporarily stunts linear growth, young people with anorexia nervosa may stop growing due to their underweight and low sex hormones. A bone age X-ray should be performed on anyone suspected of not having achieved their full height before administering sex hormones, either transdermal estrogen or transdermal testosterone. The X-ray can evaluate whether growth plates have closed. I have taken care of 17-year-olds who had the bone age of 13-year-olds. If testosterone were administered to that individual, their growth plates would slam shut and they would stop growing forever. In males who have normal testosterone levels and females past childbearing age, the question is more easily answered. I would readily prescribe bisphosphonates for them. Linear growth, aka the height question. Short stature is a topic relevant to both male and female patients. In malnutrition, patients of both sexes develop growth hormone resistance. This means that they actually have height levels of growth hormone, but the cells do not respond to it. Once again, the cave person brain is working to spare calories for life-saving functions, and growth isn't one of them. Taking growth hormone while still underweight is useless because patients already have high natural levels of growth hormone. It's just that their body can't respond to it. I come back to one of my favorite themes. These patients don't have a hormonal or growth problem. They have a nutrition problem. Thus, there must be a nutritional solution. Menstrual periods. Having reviewed brain changes and bone density considerations in anorexia nervosa, let's turn to the topic of menstrual periods. In the past, the diagnosis of anorexia nervosa in a female patient required the absence of menstrual periods, called amenorrhea. However, in 2013, the DSM-5 removed the requirement of amenorrhea from the diagnosis of anorexia nervosa in females. That's because it has become clear that menstrual function varies widely from person to person. For instance, in one study, 50% of patients resumed their menstrual period once they re regained at least a low normal weight range and 23% body fat. However, fully a quarter of patients either maintained or resumed their menstrual period while significantly underweight, with a body fat percentage of only 11%. Furthermore, fat percentage measurements have been found to be no better than body mass index, or BMI, at predicting menstrual resumption. Another study showed that 38% of patients who were restricting calories lost their period while still at a normal BMI. The authors conclude that many adults have symptoms of starvation without clinical underweight. This is entirely congruent with my own experience. Classical teaching holds that 90% of women who achieve 90% of their expected body weight will resume their menstrual period within 6 months. Studies have also highlighted the role of stress, regardless of nutritional status and body weight, in the development of menstrual dysfunction. When a post-adolescent, premenopausal woman has anorexia nervosa, the natural return of the period is often heralded as the Mother Nature is happy moment. However, on one hand, I've had many patients whose periods persisted despite eating disorder behaviors with and without weight loss. They easily wonder if they're not sick enough yet, given that their body is well enough to menstruate regularly. On the other hand, I've had patients who have been weight restored and recovery for 2 years, still waiting in vain for their period to come back. This almost certainly circles back to genetic variability. Even within the same patient, different relapses can induce different menstrual patterns. In addition to a bone density study, females with malnutrition and the absence of a menstrual period need to have a blood estradiol level checked. While normal estradiol levels vary widely through a normal menstrual cycle, consistent levels of less than 30 pg per milliliter are considered low. When the estradiol is low and weight restoration or work on an eating disorder behaviors is ongoing, it is fair to assume that the cave person brain remains quiescent with regards to sex hormones. When the level starts to rise, the weight has been in a reasonable range for 6 to 12 months, and the period still hasn't returned. We can use another tool in the toolkit, pelvic ultrasound. Pelvic ultrasound is more often used in Europe than in the United States. Its premise is sound. Low estrogen levels from the hypothalamic hypogonadism will actually make a woman's ovaries and uterus shrink back toward prepubescent sizes. The pelvic ultrasound can evaluate ovarian maturity and uterine size. If the pelvic ultrasound shows a small uterus and immature ovaries, then the hypothalamus has not yet woken up due to insufficient weight restoration or insufficient time at the restored weight. A study showed that almost 90% of women required weight restoration to a BMI of over 20 kilograms per meter squared for ovarian maturity to occur. Furthermore, a BMI of 19 kilograms per meter squared, only 40% of women had achieved reproductive maturity. In the final analysis, even after eating disorder recovery, there are patients who still have menstrual irregularity, or who carry the diagnosis of polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS. I'm always willing to refer them to an endocrinologist, someone who optimally, someone with some eating disorder expertise, when their needs fall beyond my own knowledge base and scope of practice. The pill. Oral contraceptive pills neither protect the bones nor jumpstart the period. This has been proven again and again by well-designed studies. Despite this, many gynecologists and general physicians continue to receive the wrong information during medical school and residency on this topic. As a result, many of my patients with amenorrhea due to an eating disorder have been prescribed the pill for indications that it absolutely does not work for. It seems that doctors and patients alike are at risk for assuming that if a woman bleeds every month on oral contraception, then she and her bones are getting what they need. This is wrong and dangerous thinking. For one, virtually anyone with a uterus and vagina, when given oral contraceptive pills, will bleed during the placebo days. This isn't jump-starting anything, it's giving someone a hormone-induced monthly blood loss. Two, if patients and their doctors feel relieved and protected while on oral contraception, their level of concern about fixing the underlying problem, the eating disorder, is likely to ebb. It's easy for the eating disorder voice to say, "See, you're getting a period now, so you aren't sick enough anymore to push ahead on your meal plan and see your therapist." 3. Starving patients can ill afford the loss of menstrual blood every month. The whole reason the hypothalamus rolled back to pre-adolescence was to spare the body of this additional drain on resources. And 4. Being on the pill prevents a woman from potentially having that yay Mother Nature moment in which she restores weight to the point that her natural menstrual cycle resumes. Assuming, of course, she's not one of those patients who resumes her period at a low weight. However, I remind patients that eggs happen. Amenorrhea is not adequate for pregnancy prevention. If the pill is the only form of consistent birth control a woman is able or willing to take, and she's sexually active with a male partner and doesn't want to get pregnant, she should definitely take the pill. Otherwise, it shouldn't be used in those with eating disorders and amenorrhea. Case resolution, Josh. Josh's new eating disorder physician shares his bone density and testosterone results with him. The diagnosis is osteoporosis, given the Z-score of negative 2.6 and low testosterone levels. Josh is also given the diagnosis of hypothalamic hypogonadism, and his doctor explains that his testosterone remains low because he never restored enough body weight for his hypothalamus to wake back up. Most likely, his intensive workout regimen after residential treatment, when he wasn't fully weight restored, contributed to rapid bone density loss. He also took no rest days for his body, which contributed to his stress fracture. The specialist warmly acknowledges the good choice Josh made to intensify his work with his outpatient team when tempted in the face of his injury to restrict calories again. She reminds him that allowing his fracture to fully heal while nourishing his body and allowing his weight to rise to a better target range are likeliest to allow him to practice the sports he loves for the rest of his life. By contrast, staying underweight and pushing too hard to cross-train vigorously or jump back in early will result in further injuries and keep him sidelined. The prescription is further weight restoration, close work with his team, and rest, gradually adding in some mindful movement, including some lifting. Josh decides to take a break from competitive cycling. Because he will not be competing in events that require drug testing, he accepts transdermal testosterone for his osteoporosis. He will use this daily until he achieves his target weight range. At that point, the testosterone will be discontinued for a few weeks, and his own levels will be tested again to see if his hypothalamus has woken back up. A DXA can be checked 1 to 2 years after he has maintained his higher body weight to determine if he will need further treatment for his bone density. He is informed it will likely never normalize. However, it can improve. His doctor notes that at his age, he can expect higher sex drive and sexual function than he currently experiences. The testosterone replacement will help with this, but not overdrive it. If normalized sex drive and function are concerning to Josh, This can be addressed in therapy. Case resolution, Ania. Ania learns that she has hypothalamic hypogonadism. While her worst Z-score of negative 1.8 was read as normal on the report, her doctor emphasizes that this is by no means actually normal for such a young woman who does weight-bearing exercise and, in fact, reflects bone density loss that should be addressed. The pelvic ultrasound that confirmed a small uterus and ovaries helped convince Ania that the weight she was considered normal was in fact too low. She had been thinking that achieving her 18-year-old pre-illness body weight and not engaging in any eating disordered behaviors were sufficient. However, she realizes now that her body is telling her, through a quiescent hypothalamus, bone density loss, and pre-adolescent size uterus and ovaries, that it wants to be at a higher adult weight. She declines the pill when she learns that it does not help bones, nor does it help jumpstart periods. Only her overall nutritional health can do that. Ania is willing to re-engage with her former eating disorder therapist and dietitian to do further weight restoration. She admits that gaining weight scares her, and she realizes she was not as solidly in recovery as she had thought. She is offered the estrogen patch and oral cyclic progesterone as a bridge for her bone health to the time when she has achieved a weight at which her period naturally restarts. However, she reasonably asks for 6 months to restore weight and see if her body naturally recycles, since she has had no fractures or complications. The doctor agrees. Case resolution, Aiden. Aiden and his parents learn that growth hormone will not be effective for him because he already has high growth hormone levels in his blood and growth hormone resistance due to his malnutrition. In addition, testosterone use could potentially close his growth plates prematurely and ensure that he will stop growing. A hand X-ray for bone age confirms that, despite being 17 years old, he has the bone age of a 14-year-old. It is very appropriate to check Aiden's bone density because it almost certainly will show some degree of bone density loss, perhaps osteoporosis, and the Z-score should be determined using his bone age of 14 instead of his chronological age of 17 years. His bone density may be a medical finding that is very motivating for recovery. Even if the DXA results are still normal, he has a higher risk for fracture simply due to his anorexia nervosa. Sustained weight restoration is his most appropriate treatment. He has a long road ahead of him given the severity of his eating disorder. Any weight loss at home should swiftly result in escalation to a higher level of care again. Exercise during recovery. Compulsive or obsessive exercise can be a feature of any eating disorder. Patients can come to feel that movement is about punishing themselves, burning calories, or weight loss. Healing this particular aspect of patients' relationships with their bodies is a key feature of the recovery process. For years, when I lectured about hormones and bones, I would cite the study that showed that any exercise while underweight worsens bone density. And I would conclude, serious exercise is a privilege of full recovery. This remains true. However, I've now revised my statement to include, but movement during weight restoration makes recovery sustainable. Many eating disorder providers and programs insist that patients minimize physical movement during eating disorder recovery. Their logic is that patients should focus all of their calories on restoring their bodies and weight. Additionally, they rightly question whether patients in the depths of their mental illness and starved brain can regulate movement and engage mindfully, as opposed to grimly counting calories or pushing themselves to extremes as they perhaps had been doing. I am convinced now, however, that eating disorder specialists should permit, where medically and psychologically appropriate, and oversee physical movement throughout the recovery progress, regardless of level of care. The brilliant physical and occupational therapists in the hospital at my previous job started me on this pathway. Very weak patients would brighten and glow as they saw rest, nutrition, and expert physical therapy, PT, and occupational therapy, OT, result in stronger, more independent bodies. They accepted nutrition and rest more readily because they saw such rapid improvements in their functional status. In my current outpatient clinic, this has become even clearer. From athletes to artists who rarely put on a pair of sneakers in patients of all sizes, I offer to get them moving as early as possible in the recovery process, to the degree that they wish to participate and are able. Asking patients not to do physical activity during the recovery unwittingly reinforces their eating disorder perception that movement is for burning calories. When we tell them not to move or that they'll burn too many calories, we are validating the eating disorder logic. Instead, the treatment team optimally can agree on a slow, stepwise increase in movement, increasing calories as needed. The therapist can process with the patient how it feels to do a wide variety of exercise, yoga one day, a walk the next, and some free weights in the third, with rest days each week. Might this contribute to some bone density loss while patients remain low on sex hormones? It might, but I'm convinced that creating a sustainable recovery plan that leads patients to long-term health most often involves movement. Their achievement of full eating disorder recovery earlier will certainly be best for their bones in the long run. One caveat is that patients who cannot medically or psychologically engage in movement safely should be encouraged to wait until the recovery is further along. As a final word, everyone working to recover from an eating disorder should put aside their step tracking devices, whether on their phones or worn as a watch, and move through the world mindfully. Any focus on the numbers, from weights to steps to calories burned to miles, risks servicing the eating disorder rather than one's true value and goals.